This is an ABC podcast.
Hi, Miyuki Okiranta here with Earshot, and with the third episode in our series, Housing the Australian Nation. Peter Mayres is interrogating Australia's housing crisis. In the last episode, he took us to Hobart, Australia's least affordable capital city rental market. In previous years, many of those tenants now struggling to pay rent to private landlords would have been accommodated in public housing instead, where the landlord is the state government and rents are always affordable because they're set at a fixed proportion of your household income. But public housing is in long-term decline all around Australia. Today, Peter travels to Adelaide, home to the once mighty South Australian Housing Trust, which in its post-war heyday set the gold standard for state housing authorities worldwide.
Hello.
Hello, Peter.
Audrey, nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
I'm visiting Audrey Hitchin in her home in Seacombe Gardens.
Lovely day we're having.
Oh, it's horrible, isn't it? Probably hit 40
nice
degrees by now.
Come down.
Thank you. It's nice and cool in here, though.
Yes.
Audrey's daughter, Lauren Botting, was also called by to join in the conversation.
Oh, a glass of water would be lovely,
Mum's
yeah.
Got lemonade and
fan. Water's just fine, cool, thank you.
It's Adelaide water, unfortunately.
Audrey is in her early 90s, and I'm keen to ask her about her long history, almost 70 years, as a tenant of the Housing Trust of South Australia.
The Housing Trust were really good to us. Myself, I think they're marvellous. They're wonderful to me. I was that thrilled to get a house.
And how old were you then?
I don't know how old I was, but I know. I don't remember back that far. Well, it's a funny thing, but I'm 20 years older than Gail, so I try and work back from there. But Gail was four.
So she was four, you were 24, something like that.
Something like that, love, yes. Sorry, I can't be more precise. So it's nearly 70 years.
So it was a brand new house when you moved in?
Oh, yes, brand new. Nobody had been in it before. Yes. It was a three-bedroomed house. Backyard was huge, of course. My husband used to cut the grass down with the scythe. It was so big in the backyard. And it was lovely in there with the kids, you know. I kept having children. I had five girls and it was just so good to have a place that you can call your own and look after it. And you do look after it like it is your own and you're paying for it. The man used to come around in a motor car and toot out the front of your place. That was a warning we were going to pay our rent that day. But we didn't mind because we were lucky to have the house.
Dad said that when the houses were built, they were made from packing cases that came from London and that was the part of the structure of the homes. Dad's story.
Lauren's family story may not be true, but the house did have some structural challenges. As the family later discovered, it had been built on the edge of a disused well.
Dad did two jobs, so he worked driving taxis and then he would be on the switchboard from 5 to 2 a.m. Mum. Dad came home and he heard a massive whoosh and the well was like an inch from the front veranda. And I remember I just started work at AMP and I grabbed my first pay packet that I had and my older sister grabbed her bikini that she'd just bought and we all had to go over to the neighbour's house. And next day we were standing there and dropping. It was a very, very deep well. There was all vineyards and almond trees.
So the house had been built on what was previously orchards or something like that.
Yeah.
The house with the collapsing well in the front yard was in a brand new suburb nestled on the southern tip of the Adelaide Plain. Seacombe Gardens transitioned rapidly from the plough to the lawnmower, with the Housing Trust of South Australia leading the development. Audrey and Lauren's neighbours were Housing Trust tenants too.
There were lovely people around, all nice people, working people, doing the same thing as us, having a family.
Lots of wonderful, happy family memories and friends, neighbours, Christmas time, we'd have Christmas cooking and we'd all be together in someone's garden and it was a really safe, lovely area.
Did you ever think about buying your own place rather than renting from the Housing Trust?
Couldn't afford it. We never had the money. I also had narcolepsy, which I couldn't work. So I had to stay home with the kids, yeah.
In In the early 1950s, when Seacombe Gardens' last almond orchards were converted into housing and Audrey Hitchin and her husband Jack moved into their brand new home, the Housing Trust of South Australia was still primarily constructing dwellings within the City of Adelaide's old metropolitan boundaries. That soon changed.
Good morning, everyone. We're broadcasting this morning from a point somewhere near the centre of the new town, and where very shortly the Premier of South Australia, the Honourable T. Playford, is to perform the brief inauguration ceremony.
In 1954, the Trust began building the new town, stamped onto farmland to the north of the city,
17 miles from the Adelaide General Post Office.
The Housing Trust was fulfilling the economic mission outlined in its first annual report in 1937, the provision of accommodation for decent living at low rentals, vital to the expansion of the industrial life of this state.
Well, the Premier, with the Chairman of the Trust, have just taken their places on the dais.
I believe that this town will be successful. Already, industries from overseas, industries from Australia, have announced their intention of establishing here in a big way.
For more than a quarter of a century, the growth and development of the South Australian Housing Trust was overseen by Australia's longest-serving state premier, the Liberal Country League's Tom or Thomas Playford, later Sir Thomas. In 1936, as a backbencher, the Gallipoli veteran and orchardist had voted against the Trust's establishment. But as Premier from 1938 on, he increased its funding and expanded its role, sometimes in the face of opposition from his Conservative colleagues.
And there has been some controversy as to what this town should be called. We sent a communication to Her Majesty the Queen, and I can announce that we have Her Majesty's gracious permission to name this town Elizabeth.
By 1960, Elizabeth, to the north of Adelaide, was the state's second largest town.
4 years, just 4 years old, and Elizabeth celebrates.
But the Trust played a lead role in stretching Adelaide's footprint southward too, developing new urban centres like Norlunga and Christie's Beach to provide housing for workers at a new oil refinery and at Mitsubishi's Lonsdale engine plant.
Bernie Van Essen, nationality Australian, but newly so after 29 years Dutch-born and bred. Occupation, milkman, and earning good money.
In the post-war years of populate or perish, many of the working families moving into Housing Trust homes were recent migrants. And the Housing Trust of South Australia didn't just build housing for rent. Many of its homes were built for sale.
Hi there.
Hi, Karen.
Karen James grew up in a three-bedroom Housing Trust home in West Beach. Her parents bought it in 1961, soon after migrating from England. And I've come to visit her widowed father, Gordon, now in his 90s, who still lives there today.
Wow, what a backyard.
That tall's a paradise.
Yeah.
Not only does Gordon James have a huge garden, but that garden backs onto acres of open space, including sports fields.
Sorry? A man's work is never
No,
finished.
I can see you hanging up your jumper there.
Yes.
Do you want to take Pete in? I'll do it, Dad.
Nice back here with the...
Oh, yeah. It's worth $1 million.
Worth... So what's this? Is this the... These are sports grounds, or...?
Yeah, there was six cricket matches going the other Sunday.
Right.
And soccer's just taken over, but as we got the advantage of having the gate here...
Oh, you can let yourself into the onto the oval.
Yeah, so you come out here, you get a good idea.
It's huge.
It's so close to the city, close to the beach. Yeah, so I go down the beach when the weather's good, you know.
You walk down?
No. I used to ride my bike till I was 89, and I fell off, and I thought, you silly old fella. Yeah, we've been here. Well, we moved in the house when it was brand new, you know.
So what year was that?
1961.
Right.
This is all Housing Trust.
Yes.
And it's one of the best things Playford ever did. The inspector came and seen the footings. The brickwork went up so high, the inspector checked it, and as stages went, everything got checked, you know. Well, it's been standing all these years now.
Oh, it looks in very good condition.
Yeah. Yes. 1961, that's correct.
Inside, over cups of tea, Gordon James shows me his original mortgage documents.
The contract was sell and purchase from the housing trustee, and we went through it and we signed it and we were granted the purchase.
That says here, shall the purchasers shall, during the period from taking possession until the day for final settlement, pay the trust by way of rent the sum of £3.10 per week.
Yeah.
So they called it rent, but actually you were paying off the purchase.
Yeah, well, yeah.
So why did you buy a house from the housing trust and not just buy a house, you know, on the open market?
Trust. I mean, the trust in the housing trust, but the word trust. They were government. Same as we always be with the Commonwealth Bank because it's government. And we knew nobody.
Was it also about what you could afford? Was that a reason for coming to the housing trust?
That's right, because all we wanted was we don't want a mansion. We just want a comfortable house. That's all we want. So that we can buy and we're settled in our old age.
When I first started, the chair of the trust board had its own office suite, secretary, bathroom, and they even had a chauffeured car in the early days.
In the decades after World War II, as it reshaped the city of Adelaide and developed satellite towns like Elizabeth and Noarlunga, the Housing Trust of South Australia was one of the state's most powerful and important institutions.
The general manager's salary was set at the same level as the head of premise department, so it was considered as one of the top jobs.
And was that because there was an understanding of how important housing was to the economic development of South Australia?
Precisely, and that was set by Playford.
Gary Storkey is the current chair of the South Australian Housing Trust Board. He doesn't have a palatial office, a private bathroom, or a chauffeur-driven car. What he does have is a long institutional memory. Prior to being appointed Trust Chair in 2018, he ran a large community housing operation in Adelaide. Before that, he worked on housing for decades as a senior state public servant. His career began, though, at the South Australian Housing Trust, as an accountant, in 1978.
It was a huge builder and developer. So it was developing urban fringe, places like Parafield Gardens, Elizabeth, obviously, parts of Salisbury, and then down south, Noarlunga, Hackham, Christie's Beach. We were the major developer of all those, and we were producing around about 3,000 houses a year.
So 3,000 houses a year, how did that compare to private sector developers at the time?
A huge amount. In fact, the private developers were divided into two groups. There was the ones that built housing trust houses. So they would get a contract from 90 to 120 houses, and you could go out to a suburb and see concrete slabs one end and a constructed house the other. It was just a pipeline. And then you had these up-and-coming new builders like the Fairmonts and the Hickenbothams, which are around today, that started buying land themselves on the fringe and doing their own developments. And they were kicking up about the construction side shouldn't be done by the Housing Trust. And that was the sort of the start of the development demise.
What was the argument for the Housing Trust having the land and developing the land versus private developers having the land and developing the land?
Well, the argument was that we provided a much broader range of affordable housing for the bottom end of families.
There are many factories making a wide range of goods and calling for a large number of trades. Food mixers and kitchen appliances are made by this well-known English company.
From the start, the Housing Trust's primary mission was urban planning for economic development. But the Trust's role went beyond building homes for the state's growing industrial workforce. As early as 1940, Liberal Premier Tom Playford gave the Trust welfare responsibilities too. He told Parliament that second-class racehorses were better accommodated than some South Australians, and he extended the Trust's brief to housing pensioners and other vulnerable citizens. Gary Storkey says that when Labor's Don Dunstan was elected Premier in 1970, he demanded that the Trust do more of that.
When Don Dunstan got elected, on his first day, on the Monday, his first duty was he went over to Alex Ramsey, the general manager of the Trust, and said, OK, Alex, either you play ball with a Labor government or I want your resignation by the end of the day. That was the start of the change to the sort of more welfare focus.
You see the Labor government under Don Dunstan as having shifted away from that housing as a form of economic development, more towards housing as a form of a government role in housing anyway, as a form of social welfare.
Yeah, and advancing social welfare to enable single mums to be looked after, shifting people out of institutions and things like that.
During the 1950s and 60s, the Housing Trust of South Australia built almost 3,000 dwellings every year. Now it struggles to build just a few hundred. It still has more than 40,000 rental homes on its books, but that's down from more than 60,000 in the early 1990s because successive state governments have sold off public housing stock. Fewer Housing Trust dwellings means tens of thousands of low-income tenants have to struggle to make ends meet in the private rental market. Sometimes half their income may go to the landlord.
We have got 20,000 people in South Australia paying more than 50% of their income in the private rental sector. I met one bloke's paying 90%. I met people that don't have the power turned on because they can't afford to pay the power bill. So one bloke I met turns the power on only on a Saturday to warm up the hot water so he can have a shower.
Housing Trust Chair Gary Storkey says the problem isn't just a shortage of dwellings, but the quality of the dwellings that are still on the Housing Trust's books, because the income it receives from rents isn't enough to cover essential costs like maintenance.
The only discretionary spending for public housing is maintenance. You've still got to pay your rates, you've still got to pay your insurance. So maintenance gets cut. And so what happened in South Australia is we've got a backlog maintenance, which we're trying to quantify, but it's in the hundreds of millions.
On average, Housing Trust properties are 40 years old, with more than 4 in 10 of them built before 1980. To make matters worse, most dwellings are no longer fit for purpose. Built as housing for economic development, they were designed to accommodate the industrial workforce of a growing state, mostly families. In the era of housing as welfare, trust tenants are very different.
So, for instance, 70-80% of it is family homes, yet 70-80%, or even higher, people coming through the front door singles. So they were not renewed in a way that they should have been renewed to meet the people that are coming through the front door.
We do have a proud history. We had enough housing to meet the need that was there. It was a system here in South Australia that was spoken about as one of the best public housing portfolios in the world.
Dr. Alice Clark is the CEO of Shelter SA, the state's peak body for housing policy and advocacy.
Ordinary people could access this housing. So you didn't need to be living in poverty to have access to a home. You could be working and have a family, but having a lower income and still be able to access public housing. So it was available to more people and ordinary families. It was a self-sustaining system. The rent was enough to keep the maintenance done, and we just don't have that anymore. We don't have that, the income and the rent for the public housing system to be self-sustaining.
The Housing Trust of South Australia is caught in a dilemma. If it was still a general developer, building dwellings for working households like it used to, then tenants' rent and the proceeds from selling houses might keep it solvent. But it would be seen as encroaching on the territory of the private sector and be opposed for that reason. As a provider of welfare housing, its primary role today, the Trust can't cover its costs and is in danger of going broke.
Today, we see a system in great decline. We have lost, over the last 20 years, more than 20,000 properties in our public housing portfolio, and we have 23,000 people experiencing homelessness every year in South Australia. And we have about 20,000 people on the public housing waiting list. We've got a system now that can't financially support itself and that is not able to house everybody who needs a house.
Today, the once mighty Housing Trust of South Australia is no longer in the business of shaping the city for economic development. But nor can it fulfil its other role of housing the vulnerable. The number of people entering the most urgent category of the public housing waiting list is about double the number that the Trust can possibly place. Alice Clark from Shelter SA.
There are people on the public housing waiting list that will never get a property because they don't fit those criteria now of high and complex needs. I think we house about 2,000 people every year, so they would be category one, you know, the highest priority that we would be managing to house, and the rest languish.
Pensioners, single parents and others might be shelling out half their income on rent, but they have little hope of getting a housing trust place unless they have high and complex needs as well. Nor can they take advantage of South Australian rules that require 15% of new dwellings in major developments be affordable, since affordable usually means 80% of the going market rate, which is still way too expensive for most low-income households. But one developer is determined to do things differently.
In summer, as you see, the windows are double glazed. Even now, but they're double glazed, you can see.
Okay.
Yep. See?
Together with Gary Storkey from the Housing Trust, I'm inspecting a brand new freestanding two-bedroom house in Hackham, a still-growing suburb about 30 kilometres south of the city centre. It's on the edge of the famous McLaren Vale wine area. The house is in Onkaparinga Views, a new estate that will eventually comprise more than 120 house and land packages, some with views down to the ocean at Port Norlunga.
Wow. Let's come have a look.
Right.
You can see the quality of this. We're able to put fans in every single room. Marble top, European appliances.
The person showing us around is the developer, Adelaide businessman Tim Shaheen. And what he's most excited about is not the quality of the appliances or the solar panels on the roof, but the price. This home and 21 others in Onkaparinga Views will be on the market for less than $200,000.
You're looking at a new affordable design concept.
What kind of money are we talking about here?
House and land package on 200 square metres, total installed, $199,000.
Is there any profit margin there?
On small volume, no. Maybe when you get into mass production, then probably, yeah. Once technology gets refined a little bit more, yeah. But in one, as always, no.
So is that the plan, mass production, mass scale?
It should be, yeah. It should be.
The steel is prefabricated in China. Everything's almost done in China. They built the whole modular in China to see what it looks like. Once we get
half the $200,000 price tag on Tim Shaheen's model home is the cost of the land. The other half is the cost of the building. And he's brought that down by developing a kit home prefabricated in China.
My name's Frank Brewer from Spectra Building Designers. This is actually a kit frame that we designed and we got it imported from overseas.
And how long does it take to build this house after the kit's imported?
Well, generally we're talking around about possibly 6 to 9 weeks.
And how does that compare to a standard greenfield development?
Normally you're talking probably 3-4 months at the best case scenario.
Even with anything that's probably remotely similar to this, nobody will commit to 3-4 months. Minimum 6 months.
So you're cutting the construction time by, let's say, 60% possibly, maybe more even, and that means a saving in costs.
Yeah, but also providing a far better concept and materials like double glazing, for instance.
6.4 energy rating.
How does that compare to other developments?
5.5. We got 6.4. I think we can get to 7. This here, the way it's basically been designed and the way we worked it out, it will cost you $1 a day to run. So you're talking about $200,000. $200,000 that even if you go and borrow the whole amount of money from the bank and you are basically paying interest and principal at $200 a week, a pension is $458, $460. So a pensioner now can afford his own house.
So for a pensioner to buy a house like this will be cheaper than them renting in the commercial market?
By far. And we've already got probably about half a dozen inquiries. And there is already one pensioner who has a small savings, a bit of savings. And CBA has already more or less approved him for the loan.
To deliver a $200,000 home, Tim Shaheen needs to bring down the costs of land. And that means convincing local councils to let him build on 200 square metres, when the minimum lot size is usually at least 300. His costings rely on buyers qualifying for a $15,000 first homeowners grant and for a government-backed Homestart loan. But he calculates that $10 million upfront from government would be enough to build 2,000 such homes a year and inject $400 million into the South Australian economy. The government would soon get its money back in tax receipts, he says, and the public housing waiting list could be slashed.
We haven't built anything that accommodates seniors, pensioners, low-income earners. We don't have a shortage of dwellings. We have a shortage or a crisis of affordable housing. You can't help everyone. We can't, as a private enterprise, we can't help everyone. But at least what you do is that you take 80% off the system to allow the government to look after the 20% properly. Because at the moment, they can't, because the system is overstressed.
A mass rollout of Tim Shaheen's $200,000 homes faces major obstacles. One is finding enough cheap land within reach of jobs and services. Another is the politics of importing kit homes built entirely in China. Welcome as they are, innovative projects like Onkaparinga Views can't replicate the large-scale public housing development of the post-war era.
I like this place. The girls did the backyard for me. It's a lovely area.
Audrey Hitchin is still a Housing Trust tenant and still in Seacombe Gardens, though no longer in the original home she moved into after the war. Today, she's in a new townhouse, just around the corner from the place where she and her late husband Jack raised their five daughters. That house was demolished and replaced with units.
It was a shame to see it get knocked down. It's lovely to see the new places, mind you. I think they needed something done about them.
Given all the Housing Trust of South Australia managed to do for her and her neighbours in those difficult post-war years, Audrey Hitchin is surprised to learn that today the Trust can't find housing for all who need it.
Back in those days, I guess there were people that waited a long time, but it was just after the war, wasn't it? And I mean, I would just thought, see, the houses they're knocking down, they're putting up three and four flats instead. I thought they'd have caught up with people wanting houses.
Long-term Housing Trust tenant, Audrey Hitchin. Housing the Australian Nation is produced and presented by Peter Mayers. Next time on Earshot, Peter travels to Brisbane to see if not-for-profit community organisations can step up to meet the challenge of housing the Australian Nation. I'm Iyuki Ranta, and I'll catch you then.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.